This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, and we've been talking about the death of George Floyd at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer and the massive nationwide protest it sparked this weekend. Now let us focus on the police officer who killed Floyd, Derek Chauvin. The Minneapolis Police Department fired him early last week, and on Friday he was arrested and charged with third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. Chauvin was with the Minneapolis Police Department for almost two decades, and in that time racked up 18 complaints against him. Only two were closed with discipline, but he was disciplined twice and still not off the force. Why was a police officer with so many complaints still on the streets? And could there be officers with similar disciplinary records in North Carolina? Dawn Blagrove is executive director for Emancipate NC, a nonprofit organization dedicated to dismantling systemic racism. She joins me now. Welcome, Dawn.
Thank you, Frank.
And I should point out we reached out to Raleigh's police chief, Cassandra Deck Brown, to join this conversation. She's not available to join us. Dawn, let me start with the protest over the last few days. We've been talking about them this hour. Emancipate NC was part of the coalition of groups that helped to organize demonstrations in Raleigh. Were you at the protests?
I was. I was one of the organizers, Emancipate NC, along with Young Americans Protest, Carolina Peace Center, Advanced NC, Recidivism Reduction Education Program Services. And together, we coalesced around what we believed was a really important moment to elevate many of the policy changes around police accountability that each of these groups individually have been working on for years. So we put together a peaceful protest, and the outcome and the turnout was amazing. There were conservatively 2,500 people at the highest peak, probably maybe around 5,000 that showed up. We protested very peacefully for a very long time. One of your earlier guests explained, and I think very accurately, what changed the tide of the evening and turned the protest from peaceful to something different. But we were very proud of what we did. We were very proud of elevating the need for police accountability and also giving people real concrete policy demands that they could take away and advocate for implementation locally.
Well, let's talk more. I do want to talk about those particular demands and sort of the ways in which you think things can change. But first of all, let's talk about the response. You talked about the protests being largely peaceful, and there were obviously moments of violence, certainly in Raleigh and other cities, not in Durham. What about the police reaction to the police response? How did you sort of observe that, and what's your take on that?
I will sum it up by saying something that my 20-year-old daughter, who was also there with me, said to me on our way home upon reflection of what she had just seen. And she said to me, "Mom, I didn't realize that police were the ones who started riots." And what I think she meant by that, and what I know she meant by that, is what she observed, was that things were peaceful. It was beautiful. There were families, small children, thousands of people. At one point, there was even during the protest, at one point, a man proposed to his now fiance. We had a beautiful event. And it was not until the RPD took a very antagonistic stance towards the protesters. We were closing down. They surrounded us. It felt as though they were surrounding us and positioning themselves to kind of cage the large portion of the crowd in. And at that point, as an organizer, we took to the podium to tell folks, listen, we recognize that the law enforcement officers here seem to be taking a more antagonistic stance and seem to be prepared and ready to take this thing in a different direction. If you are here with small children, if you choose to stay and interact with law enforcement in the way that they appear to want to interact, you do that. But if not, please, now is the time to leave. And it was apparent that law enforcement had decided that we had overstayed our welcome or whatever the case may be, but that they decided that at that point, our constitutional rights to protest peacefully had come to an end. We had overstayed our welcome, and they were going to posture themselves in a way that elicited a fight or flight response from the people who were protesting, and that's exactly what happened.
So when you, and of course, the police chief says that while you're right, there was a change in posture, and she acknowledged that. She also said that the police did escalate the situation after the bottles and rocks were being thrown. But in her sequence of events, the police may have postured themselves, and however much more aggressive they may have looked than a few moments earlier, the fact was, she said, the bottles came from the crowd, and that's when the rubber bullets and the tear gas and all of the weapons were unleashed by the police. What about that?
Well, Frank, what I'll tell you is I personally was not there when the first canisters of tear gas were released on the crowds. But from the reports that I have seen on social media, from the people who I've talked to who were present, including one of Governor Cooper's staff who was there when the initial tear gas was released and was tear gas, that is not what the people say happened. But I would posture this, and it leads us, I think, to the conversation about police accountability. Even if there were people in the crowd who threw empty water bottles at law enforcement, the response and aggression from them at that point was completely disproportional to what they had experienced, even if what they're saying is true. I think that in and of itself is a problem. Even if what they're saying is true, that response was so disproportionate to what they claim to have been the aggravator. And the reason that they feel that level of response is okay is because there is no accountability. There is no sense of professionalism or community that exists when they are thinking about interacting with people in the street that are their citizens, that are their communities, that pays their tax.
Well, let's talk about those accountability measures and things that you would like to see change for more accountability and hopefully reduce some of what we're seeing.
So as the organizations, we came together, like I mentioned earlier, around a set of very policy demands. And again, I want to be clear, we didn't come up with these demands in response to the murder of Mr. Floyd. We have been working on these same sets of demands, asking for these same policy changes for years and years and years. My organization is statewide, so we do this work all over the state, but there are many organizations like the Raleigh Pact or the Fayetteville Pact in Fayetteville, North Carolina, who have also been working very hard locally to get measures in place to create accountability. So the first thing that we believe that we need on a very local level is police oversight. And the reason that but not just police oversight with subpoena power and investigatory power.
Because right now, when task force, let me interrupt, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but if a task force is impaneled, that task force doesn't have any subpoena power, so it's really a kind of the mayor can say, I've got a task force looking into this, but they can't because they can't subpoena anybody, right?
That's exactly right. And not only can they not look into it, in many instances, in Raleigh, for example, they created a task force or an oversight board and specifically said the board cannot offer policy. The board cannot collect data. The board cannot investigate. So there's more things that this board cannot do than that it can do. And what we really want to emphasize is that one of the problems with police accountability is the disproportionate level of power that law enforcement has in our community. They are protected by laws. When they commit bad acts, they are protected by sovereign immunity. by the city, so they don't feel any personal financial impact when they commit bad acts, and they're not losing their jobs when they commit bad acts. And because of that, they feel a disproportionate amount of power in their relationship with the community. An oversight board with the power to investigate and to subpoena would create a balance of power that I think would be the beginning to repairing the trust relationship between law enforcement and many communities.
Can cities do that by themselves, or do they need authority from the legislature to grant subpoena power?
So they need authority to grant subpoena power. Where that authority comes from, under traditional thinking, is from the General Assembly. The General Assembly obviously has been reluctant to create that type of legislative change. But I do believe that there are other ways to skin this cat. We believe very strongly that Governor Cooper could use his executive power to allow citizens advisory boards across the state to have subpoena power to do the type of investigating that they need to do, and to really, like I said, ultimately redistribute the power between law enforcement and the community.
Talk about the problem of the wandering officer.
The wandering officer. Again, the wandering officer, for those who've never heard the term, is a bad police officer who is disciplined in one police agency or one law enforcement agency, released from that agency, and then able to get hired at another agency, despite his record of discipline, despite having been released for being a bad actor somewhere else. What we find, and what first, there is a difficulty collecting data on those officers because the police lobby and law enforcement lobby have worked very, very hard to make sure that data is not collected or accessible in any real way. That's the first thing that we need to change. But these officers are then allowed to, because of police culture and because of the way they protect one another within law enforcement, these bad officers, even though everyone else knows that they're a bad officer, are still able to go and get more jobs in law enforcement and be put back into a position of trust when clearly they've abused that trust and don't deserve it. If that person is hired, for example, anywhere in North Carolina, we have statutes that clearly prohibit the community from even knowing if that officer has any grievances filed against him, because his or her personnel file has been deemed not a public record. So it is not available to the public upon demand. That is one of the very first things that we need to change. Law enforcement needs transparency around its grievance process. We need transparency for the community to know which officers regularly abuse the trust of the community.
It seems that would go a long way to reinforcing what you hear from many law enforcement agencies, which is that there's not a problem with our agency. We've just got a few bad cops. The problem in the community is when you circle the wagons and protect these cops, then it is all of you, because you're all protecting the one bad cop. So you'd go a long way to, I guess, promoting not only transparency but trust if you'd say, yes, and we're happy to give up the bad ones.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that – but I think the fact that the culture pushes – the law enforcement culture and the law enforcement community pushes back so hardly against – creating sunshine and giving up these bad officers, that it further reinforces the disconnect and the lack of trust between the communities that are over-policed already.
Now, to some extent, it seems though the police force might be at the bottom of the food chain here when it comes to enforcement. How much of this is the responsibility of the city manager, the mayor? Do they have access to these records? And where are the pressure points? Where should we be putting the pressure? Is it on the police chief or on the mayor, the city council?
The pressure is on, inevitably, for local law enforcement, it is on local city council members. They absolutely do. And as a matter of fact, the city council is the body that determines who the keeper of that information even is. So they determine who it is that keeps grievances, who it is that keeps personnel files, who is the custodian of those files. they have the authority to determine whether or not I or anyone else is able to have access to those files. If we want to see change, we need to create change on the city council so that we can hire a chief of police in whatever city you live in North Carolina that reflects the values of the community. But also, Frank, the chief of police could also do something. There is a provision inside of the North Carolina law that says that if the city employee puts a waiver in their personnel file that says that the community can have access to it, then everyone could do that. And that would be a way to circumvent the law on a local level and allow a good faith effort from our law enforcement community to show the folks in Raleigh or the folks in whatever city we're talking about that you really do believe in transparency, that you really do believe in creating trust, and more importantly, that you really are making strong efforts to weed out the bad apples.
Dawn Blagrove, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Frank.
Dawn is the executive director of Emancipate NC, and you can find out more about the organization and our show at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.